from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Quick, what's the one presidential address that comes to mind when you think about presidential addresses? Gettysburg, right? Well, that wasn't always the go-to address. For decades, it was Washington's farewell message to the country that people remembered. It was impossible to memorize it more than 6,000 words, but the journalist John Avalon says it was quoted everywhere, on stamps, in sermons, in speeches. It was put on postcards and baseball cards, and then it was practically forgotten. Avalon has written a book where he says it's time to take Washington's address down from the shelf, dust it off, and apply its message to our current condition. Washington warned about partisan gridlock, about debt, foreign wars, but he also had a vision for education and faith and virtue. Avalon will join us on this President's Day to talk about Washington's farewell after the news.
Hey, you. We thought you'd want to know that the book we're talking about on today's podcast just happens to be available on Audible. Go to RadioWest.org and you'll find a link included with the show, along with links to IndieBound and Amazon, and any purchases you make through these affiliate partners help support Radio West. Thanks so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist John Avalon wants people to think about George Washington's farewell address to the country like they used to. There was a time when everyone knew the address. It was taught in civics classes. You could find parts of it in sermons, on postcards and stamps. It wasn't actually an address. It was an essay published in one newspaper that Washington had spent years fine-tuning, a message he wanted to deliver as he left the presidency. Now, everyone used to pick the parts of the address that worked for them, the part about religion's role in the country, for example, or the part about being wary of foreign conflicts or political moderation. But either way, it was always celebrated as civic scripture, Avalon says. And then for whatever reason, it fell out of favor. Whole generations now barely know it. Avalon says, though, the farewell address is due for a resurgence. And in his new book, he says Washington's advice about America's challenges has taken on a new urgency. As he writes in the book, hyperpartisanship, check. Excessive debt, check. Endless entanglements in foreign wars, check, check. Today in the program, John Avalon is joining us to talk about Washington's address. And he says it's not just a statement of the problems. Our first president steered us toward solutions. The book is called Washington's Farewell, the Founding Fathers' Warning to Future Generations, and John Avalon is joining us to talk about it. John is the editor-in-chief of The Daily Beast and a CNN political analyst. He's the author of a number of books about American politics, including Independent Nation, How Centrists Can Change American Politics. He's joining us today from a studio in New York City, and John Avalon, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. It's always a pleasure to be with you on Radio West. Good talking to you.
I guess I wanted to get a sense of when you started thinking about this. Was it in anticipation of what you were going to expect? Not with the Trump presidency necessarily, but with what was clearly a rancorous political campaign. I mean, what first got you thinking about it?
You know, Washington's farewell address, as you say, has been all but forgotten. But I kept bumping into aspects of its wisdom, and it spoke so clearly to me. You know, in a time when we've been dealing with hyperpartisanship and polarization, and very often people and political parties try to appropriate the founding fathers or the American flag and claim them as their own. Here's George Washington, the ultimate primary source in American politics, warning us with this eerie prophetic insight about the dangers of hyperpartisanship, about the dangers of polarization. And so I closed my previous book, Wingnuts, with an extended riff off the farewell address, saying that George Washington warned us about the wingnuts. And then as I got deeper into the address itself and the different facets of it, I became fascinated that Washington was thinking about America as a civilization at a time when some people were thinking about America as a civilization in decline. Mm-hmm. And he was reflecting on the lessons from his life and his understanding of human history about the forces that had destroyed democratic republics before us, hyperpartisanship, excessive debt, foreign wars, and then steered us toward solutions, these renewable sources of strength, national unity, religious pluralism, education. And it just seemed so urgently relevant as an opportunity to maybe, just maybe, offer a reset, to reunite the nation and offer some common ground and common purpose. And certainly when the book came out, which was the day of President Obama's farewell address, when he quoted George Washington's farewell address, that was stark. But I think in the current environment we're in, I think the speech has new relevance and new urgency, which is why it's a pleasure to talk to you on President's Day about it.
Is there one of these pillars that Washington wrote about? And we'll go through them, many of them anyway, as we go. One of them that rises to the top for you now, hyperpartisanship, clearly. But maybe it's education. Maybe it's virtue. Maybe it's debt. I mean, there's so many crucial ones. Is there one that you're thinking about particularly right now?
Look, I think the situation we're in as a country, because it's really important to try to figure out how to unite as a nation. Remember, the character of the country doesn't change after Election Day, and that we do have a deeper obligation to tap into the sense of responsibility that should come with self-government. But that we have been playing with the forces of polarization and hyperpartisanship. So Washington's warning against hyperpartisanship and his advocacy of the strength of political moderation always feels the most urgent to me. And I think especially because he warned that one of the things that could happen if we degenerated into regional political parties, if special interests started to hijack the national interest, that it could create such a dysfunctional democracy that citizens would become frustrated and disgusted, and that could open the door to a demagogue with authoritarian ambitions. That certainly feels urgent. But on my reflecting on all of this, I got to say that one of the remedies, besides a vigorous citizenry, which is what Washington talks about, the central responsibility of self-governance that we take for granted too often, is also civics education and Washington's warning about the importance of enlightened opinion being essential to a self-governing society. Enlightened opinion. And that's a responsibility that all citizens have that we can't take for granted anymore.
You talk about how it used to be, and I mentioned this in the introduction, quoted on stamps, was put on baseball cards and postcards. It was used to sell candlesticks. I mean, it was everywhere at some point. And one of the things you think is that it's receiving, as you say, a resurgence, that we're starting to think about it again. But why do you think it had been forgotten for a time? Why did it fall out of favor?
Well, that's actually a fascinating story. And possibly my favorite part of the book is the third section, which is the afterlife of the idea. You know, when Andrew Jackson gave his farewell address, it was almost entirely a riff on Washington's farewell address. When Abraham Lincoln campaigns in 1860, a reference and riff on the farewell address is a standard part of his stump speech. He orders it to be read aloud to troops in the middle of the Civil War to remind them what they're fighting for. And then after the war, it's deployed in America's public schools as a way of reuniting the nation. And it really becomes a form of conscious civic indoctrination, that if we can remember these rules, this parting wisdom from the founding father, we'll be all right. And it starts to fade around the First World War. And the reason is that Woodrow Wilson, himself a Washington biographer, squares off against Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, who'd written a 4-volume biography of Washington himself, over whether the United States should get involved in the First World War. And then whether we should embrace the League of Nations, which was Wilson's proposal after the fact. And because the folks arguing for Washington's farewell's precedent that we can't get involved in foreign wars and entangling alliances, they at least lost the argument about getting involved in the First World War. Washington takes a hit. And indeed, you start to see a whole series of biographies about Washington, which are critical. For the first time in American history. And then FDR kind of gives it the coup de grace because he overturns the two-term president, which Washington sets with the farewell. You know, we take the peaceful transfer of power, the two-term president, for granted. That was part of what was called the unwritten Constitution. But FDR throws that out the window. Runs for a third term at precisely the same time he's basically planning, though denying it publicly, to get America involved in the Second World War, which Pearl Harbor, of course, made inevitable. And that combination really took Washington's farewell and put it on the back shelf. And it became a document that just wasn't referred to as much anymore. And as you say, the Gettysburg Address takes the place of it as our nation's go-to civic scripture. What I say in the book is, though, the Washington's farewell is sort of the Old Testament of American politics.
Right.
Right. It's this rules of behavior dispatched by a distant God.
Yeah. And 6,000 words.
Yeah, 6,000 words.
Compared to what was it, 700 or something, yeah.
No, 272.
272, that's what I meant, yeah.
You know, well, kids did memorize Washington's Farewell at one point, which seems amazing. But 272, and the Gettysburg Address is clearly the New Testament of American politics.
Right,
it's this poetic rumination on life after death, and it's much more accessible. And although I think Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton did us all a favor by having an entire song about Washington's farewell, which I was delighted by, it really did fall out of favor. But it's just too relevant, too urgent, too able to unite disparate tribes of Americans right now for us not to remember its centrality.
We'll come back to the Hamilton play, actually. I think that's a fascinating way of getting it back into the American conversation. But I want to ask you about this. There's a photo in the book two actually pretty stark photos from a 1939 rally in Madison Square Garden. These were members of the German American Bund. This was this Nazi front organization. And as America's trying to figure out whether or not it's going to do something about Adolf Hitler in the years just before the war breaks out, this group of Nazis invoke and, in fact, have this huge image of George Washington right in front of them at this gathering, which is, I think, a perfect illustration of how people could take that farewell address and distort it for their own needs.
Yeah, which it's a harrowing moment and a fascinating aspect in the twists and turns of the farewell address's afterlife. And it looks like something. When you look at those photographs, it looks like something out of the Twilight Zone or Dark Mirror.
Yeah.
But it's absolutely real. In February 1939, the German-American Bund holds a rally in Madison Square Garden. 20,000 American Nazi supporters show up. And at the top of the garden, they have a 30-foot banner of George Washington flanked by swastika flags.
Yeah.
And the keynote speech, and they're handing out flyers calling, George Washington the first Nazi. And the keynote speech, as you say, is all about misappropriating the farewell address, saying he warned us to remain faithful to religion. He warned us against the perils of excessive debt. And especially, he warned us against the dangers of getting involved in foreign wars. And what's particularly odious about the appropriation, and somewhat ironic, is it's as clear as example of there is for what Washington warned about when he called people pretend patriots. Those people who would try to say they're representing America's true interests, but they're trying to divide fellow Americans, not unite them. And that was one of Washington's key criteria. And here, explicitly in the service of a foreign government, which Washington also warned about. The German-American Bund was taking money from Adolf Hitler.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the Nazi Party. But, you know, in as horrific and odious as that example is and forgotten about and fascinating, it also represented a high watermark for that movement, and it provoked a massive public backlash, appropriately so. And the German-American Bund leaders were ultimately jailed for taking money from Hitler. You know, you can't call George Washington the first Nazi and get away with it.
Right.
But the fact that it's so resonant, and Washington's farewell was also embraced at a similar time with different iconography and purposes, to be fair, by the American First Movement.
Yeah.
Which Donald Trump embraced the name of, if nothing else, Charles Lindbergh, Henry Ford, and others who were arguing that America should not get involved in the war against Adolf Hitler. That just is one of the things that makes these echoes. You know, it's the great Mark Twain line: history doesn't repeat, but sometimes it rhymes.
Right.
So we have an obligation to keep an eye out, an ear out for those echoes, and they can provide some guidance, some reality check for us in our current events.
How malleable is that address? Can it be adapted to any philosophy in the sense that it potentially could, lose its original meaning? Because it seems like you're getting the same kinds of debates about Washington's farewell address as you are about the Constitution and the intent of the framers. I mean, did that ever worry you that you could – it's so plastic, that document, that you could make it fit into anything?
It's only plastic if you don't actually do the homework to understand the context. Yeah. I mean, and so that's the important point here. You know, people, a 6,000-word address, people can borrow a single line and twist it and misinterpret it. The argument that, you know, that we just have been talking about, which is that Washington was advocating isolation, is self-evidently wrong if you look at the address.
Yeah.
He's arguing for a foreign policy of independence that's crucially and importantly different. But so I'm not – that didn't make me reluctant to wade back in. It makes it, I think, more urgent to grab it with both hands. And when the people are trying to misappropriate, as they often do, the wisdom of the founding fathers to excuse their own excesses or their own ideology, you need to come into that battle girded up. But if you do, their arguments fall away really quickly. And I think that's an obligation we have as citizens. That's why civic education is so darn important.
John Avalon is with us. His book is Washington's Farewell, The Founding Fathers' Warning to Future Generations. We'll take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, in honor of the holiday, we're talking about George Washington's farewell message to the country. It's known as Washington's Farewell Address, though he never gave it as a speech. It was an essay that he spent years working out. John Avalon tells the story of the address in his book, Washington's Farewell, and he's joining us from a studio in New York City to talk about it. All right, so let's get the setting for this this address. The lion wants to retire, as you put it in the book. Washington is 64. His health is beginning to fail. As you put it, he has only one tooth left. He's short-tempered in private and kind of brittle. Set up the circumstances for the address.
You know, I think folks don't appreciate what a reluctant president Washington really was. It wasn't just a pose. And he felt actually fairly insecure about his own talents, not as a general, not as a farmer, but as a statesman. And by the end of his first term, he wants to retire. Washington's an independent president. He does not believe in political parties. It's worth noting that the Constitution doesn't mention political parties.
Right.
It does mention journalists, I'll say, but it does not mention political parties.
Okay.
And Washington wants to retire because he's actually disgusted at the fact that he's being attacked by the newspapers, but his warning against partisanship is being ignored by his most talented surrogate sons, even in his own cabinet.
Yeah.
But he becomes convinced that if he retire, and he orders James Madison to work with him on a farewell address, which Madison does. But as Washington contemplates retirement, as much as he wants to do it, he becomes convinced that if he retires, there will be a civil war. Remember, this is, you know, less than two decades after the Declaration of Independence. America's first government, the Articles of Confederation, had already failed. And everybody assumed that the American experiment would fail. All democratic republics had, as John Adams once said, you know, there hasn't yet been a democracy that didn't die by suicide. And so Washington and the founders knew they were playing for history's stakes. And so he stayed on for another term, during which period he broke with Jefferson and Madison entirely because they form a political party to attack him and his policy of neutrality. They idolize the French Revolution. Washington believes that we need to stare a middle path between monarchy and the mob. So at the end of his second term...
Wait, hold on. I just want to point something out.
Sure.
Because I think it's important to say, talk about James Madison's role here. So
sure.
He asks Madison toward the end of what he hopes, the end, you know, of the first term. He decides to stay. But he tells James Madison, all right, start writing a farewell address, where he employs, and you write about this, these ideas of hyper-partisanship as concern. So it's interesting Madison's role here, because it seems like he's helping Washington talk about the problems of hyperpartisanship, even though he's really playing a role in what seems to be the burgeoning, the nascent partisanship in the country.
It is fascinating. I mean, the characters of the founding fathers, I mean, it's these disparate characters, and their evolution is out of a movie script.
Yeah.
Madison in particular is the most frustrating because he has this massively impactful flip-flop on the subject of partisanship and national unity. Madison, who writes the Constitution, Madison, who is George Washington's closest aide during the Constitution and during his first term, he writes Washington's inauguration address with him. Yeah. He helps Washington write statements to the Congress and then writes the congressional response. And in the Federalist Papers, he and Hamilton are working so closely together, and they warn against hyperpartisanship, and they venerate the idea of moderation. And then Madison falls as a congressman under the sway of Thomas Jefferson, who thinks that Hamilton is hijacking the revolution and George Washington and putting in place a British system.
Right.
And so the divides even before their politics are remarkably consistent. There are people who focus on national unity, who want a strong central government. They tend to be from cities. And there are people who focus on states' rights, and they are deeply distrustful about excesses of federal power. And they really are concerned that that federal power will come and change their way of life and intrude on them economically and culturally. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
Both sides think they're fighting for freedom,
right.
And Washington is trying to reconcile the two mightily. But Madison is the one who really flip-flops camps, and he ends up developing a partisan newspaper with Thomas Jefferson under Washington's nose and a political party to oppose Washington. And there is a deep break between the two that never heals. But Hamilton remains true.
Right.
He and Jefferson are both fascinating, flawed figures. Jefferson is really duplicitous. He doesn't like fighting his own fights directly. Hamilton is headstrong. He delights in office politics. But he and Washington, because their identities, their political identities and philosophical beliefs are forged in the Revolutionary War, where they're working together day by day. Hamilton essentially is his speechwriter and mm-hmm. chief of staff. And they develop a real belief in the need for a stronger central government because the Continental Congress is so weak and so ineffectual. They believe that you need a strong fiscal foundation for an army or a country because America almost lost the war because of the absence of that. And those beliefs really solidify them, and then that's even further forged in the crucible of the administration where they come under such vicious attack,
yeah.
Which people don't remember. So the relationships and how they line up and how they inform the farewell address are really fascinating. But Madison is this tragic figure because he's so brilliant. And he's tiny and dour and dresses like a tiny pilgrim, and he's constantly sickly. But he's the guy who develops more than any of them. He studies how past democratic republics and confederacies have failed, and Washington copies the notes into his own hand. And that really provides a great deal of the background understanding that informs the Constitution and informs the farewell address. The founders were studying history to see if they could avoid making similar mistakes.
I want to ask you about George Washington's previous goodbye. As you say in the book, he had a genius for goodbyes. And his first farewell address was also pretty memorable. This was when he was getting ready to resign his commission as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army. And then from his point of view anyway, at least he was hoping, is to head off into the sunset, go off to his farm, and just live the life as a gentleman farmer. And so he creates an address to say goodbye. Are you seeing elements of that address in his final farewell?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that's so fascinating about this document. It's the autobiography of his ideas.
Yeah.
And Hamilton is the primary speechwriter on the final farewell. And many of the words are Hamilton's, but the ideas are all Washington's, and they've been developed over a half century of public service in War and Peace. And that circular letter to the states he writes when he's resigning his commission as head of the Continental Army, which, by the way, was itself unprecedented. When George III heard that Washington was going to leave power after winning the Revolution, he remarked to an American painter who was in court at the time, if he does that, he'll be the greatest man in the world.
Yeah.
Because that wasn't done. And Washington, you know, it wasn't simply a Cincinnatus pose. It was sincere. But because he seemed not to lust after power, people trusted him with power. And I think that's a profound lesson we forget sometimes as well. But in the circular address, he says, look, we have won this. If citizens of this newfound land can't make themselves be happy in this wonderful circumstance we have, protected from the problems of Europe of an ocean, blessed with a fertile land. He understands the benefits of geography, perhaps only as soldiers fully can and farmers. It will be your fault. And that's what I think in the pillars of liberty that Washington sets out, which is a phrase he uses and begins to articulate in that circular address to the states. The word liberty has a different connotation, I think, than we appreciate today. We can consider it synonymous with freedom. It wasn't to the founding fathers. Freedom can be a state of nature.
Yeah.
Liberty implies a degree of self-discipline.
Right.
It's the responsibility of self-governance. And that's what Washington keeps hammering home. But there's total philosophical consistency between the two, from warning about the rise of self-interested political parties that could make deliberations in a democracy totally dysfunctional, to the importance of religious pluralism, to the dangers of excessive debt and paying off your debts, including to American soldiers.
Spring of 1796, you say in the book, is when Washington really starts fine-tuning this document. He starts corresponding with Hamilton about writing the address. As you say, it was Hamilton's prose, but Washington's ideas. And Washington is deeply involved in the process. You mentioned how he sharpened his own quills and spent hours at night working on it. And thank heavens there's, I guess, only one letter surviving that actually refers to him contemporaneously writing the farewell address.
From his step-granddaughter, Nellie Custis, who's this fascinating figure. She's this teenage wild child living in the first executive mansion in Philadelphia. She's got a green parrot, and she rebels against her grandmother Martha's demands that she take harpsichord lessons. But she leaves us this one letter written decades later where she recounts watching Washington write the final address in his own hand. And Washington's edits in the final document are themselves fascinating because he's very mindful of history's eyes and how things might be misinterpreted. For example, he makes very minute edits to make it clear that he's not against all debt. He thinks small amount of debt can be very good for a nation. He's become convinced because he has always had a horror of speculators, and he was deeply in debt. Even as president, going to his inauguration as president-elect, he is trying to raise money from his neighbors to pay off the tax collector, and he finds his credit isn't good enough. It's deeply humiliating, and it all stems from his obsession with self-sufficiency. When we get into too much debt, we lose our liberty. We lose our self-sufficiency. But Nellie recounts him writing it by candlelight in the executive mansion, which has since been torn down, the very first one in Philadelphia, which was our second capital. It's a stirring moment. But part of what it all is, and this is a project I tried to achieve with the book, is to take the man off the pedestal we put him on. Because when we do that with the founding fathers, when we treat them with distance, which Washington tried to cultivate, to be clear, we make their wisdom less accessible. And it's far more enriching to see them as flawed, interesting human beings, because then we can commune with them more clearly across the ages.
It's not an address. We refer to it as an address. It's basically an essay that's published on page 2 and 3 of a newspaper.
Surrounded by advertisements for tobacco and slaves and rum.
Yeah.
It's an open letter to the American people. And Washington, this is a very conscious decision on his part. One of the reasons he's in such psychic pain is he's getting savaged in the newspapers of the day, the partisan papers of the day, one of which was famously started by Madison and Jefferson, with Jefferson employing the editor in the State Department, in Washington's State Department, which is just an amazing degree of duplicity, to attack Washington and the administration's policies. But he writes an open letter to the American people, and he addresses it to his friends and fellow citizens, which I think is a lovely phrase we should remember and use more. Friends and fellow citizens. And he could have published in one of the pro-administration partisan newspapers, but he notably declines to do that. Instead, he goes for the American Daily Advertiser, which has a reputation for independence, partly because, frankly, they have printing contracts from Congress. But he wants to put forward a unifying message. And one of the really poetic aspects of the speeches of the farewell address's composition is that he has the greatest team of ghostwriters in American history. Madison works on the first draft.
Right.
Hamilton does the second. And then Washington insists at the very end that John Jay, the first Supreme Court Chief Justice and then governor of New York, comes in as a final editor, a final, you know, pair of eyes. And in doing so, he gets the band back together of the Federalist Papers
right,
authors.
Right.
And it's as if he's trying to say he's consciously trying to create a document beyond partisanship. And he chooses a newspaper that has that credibility as well, knowing that it will be disseminated. And he negotiates. He gives this editor the scoop of the century, yeah. And then gives him the final draft kind of impetuously.
And the guy wants to cut some of it to fit for space, and Washington is not having that.
No. Washington has spent way too much time making sure that everything is there for a purpose, and he's being incredibly precise. And then he leaves Philadelphia that morning before the newspaper hits the streets.
Man, he knew how to make an exit, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Well, he understood that sometimes absence can be a higher form of presence.
Yeah.
And he used that politically.
You talk about Washington's farewell address as offering a kind of roadmap for the future, diagnosing problems, you say, that afflicted republics throughout history, not just his experience, mm-hmm. Washington's direct experience. So I want to break down a few of these pillars. National unity, you mentioned, but I want to jump over that a bit and then get to virtue and religion.
Sure.
Let's talk about that, because here's what Washington's address says about that. He says, reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in the exclusion of religious principle. Now, it sounds like he's saying, and maybe he is for his time, we can't really have morality as a people if we're not religious. But I think it's more complicated than that. As you say, Washington's own vision of faith wasn't really orthodox, and it wasn't strident. It was more tolerant than that.
Yeah, and that's one of, I think, the really important aspects that resonates contemporarily. You know, Ronald Reagan loved quoting this part of the farewell address. He quoted it in his speech at Moscow State University. But I think very often George Washington is invoked by people to act as an emissary for their own agendas, and that can happen absolutely with religion and has throughout. Washington was certainly culturally a Christian. Mm-hmm. He was influenced by his membership in the local Masons that he was a part of. But he was not an orthodox believer or a literalist. And in fact, there's a great anecdote I found where he is criticized from the pulpit in Philadelphia for not taking communion. Martha always took communion. Washington would never take communion, and he would never kneel. He also always avoided using the word Jesus Christ in his correspondence. And so a young priest decided he would make a point and call out the president for this somewhat indirectly. And Washington heard it and was asked about it at a dinner by a senator a few days later. And he said, I did hear it. And he said, well, what are you going to do? And he said, well, I'm not going to go back to that church, but not for the reasons you might think. I'm aware of the responsibility I have, Washington said, to create the precedent of precedent. But I also don't want people to accuse me of hypocrisy and using religion or changing my habits or beliefs for political gain. He was a genuinely modest man, but he was passionate his entire life about religious tolerance. There's an amazing letter where he's looking for new workers at Mount Vernon, and he says, "Look, if they're Christian, Jewish, even Mohammedan," he says, using the phrase what I imagine was contemporary for Muslim, "or of no religion at all, that's fine with me." And one of the most striking declarations of his belief in his vision of faith comes in his letter to the Hebrew congregation in Newport, Rhode Island, where he really sets us out a vision of America as a beacon of religious liberty, and makes it very clear that it's not America is not a nation founded upon one denomination or one religion, but that we're a beacon of religious liberty. And the reason he's so passionate about that is because he believes that religion is the most effective way to teach virtue on a mass scale. And as long as there's a reasonable degree of assimilation that they adopt to our laws, that they really, he always says, citizens by birth or choice, mm-hmm. as long as they venerate their role as Americans, what unites them over what divides them, that religious pluralism is a source of great strength because it can communicate virtue over a very wide scale. And he was deeply passionate about that point.
It seems like, and I think you used this word, he saw religion from an entirely pragmatic or utilitarian perspective. People of faith I think from Washington's view, we're just more likely to be, as you put it, constructive members of society. That was a good framework for them to figure out this idea of virtue.
Yeah, and he was very, very clear about that. And I think that's it is pragmatic. It's not cold. But Washington's deepest, you know, he communed deeply with the Stoics, with Seneca. He got a lot of comfort from that. As well as the Bible, as well as his favorite play, Cato, which was about a Roman general. So he had these sort of his own civic scriptures and religious scriptures that gave him comfort. But he was not a doctrinaire man of faith. He believed simply that it provided a wonderful civic glue for responsible citizenship, and that was necessary to the project of self-governance. And it's remarkably contemporary in a way.
You say that first draft of the address didn't dwell on religion, but it seems like Alexander Hamilton, when he got involved, language about religion ramped up a bit, even though Washington came back in and really edited that section.
Yeah. Hamilton's got a fascinating relationship with the faith. It apparently was very significant when he was younger and survived this hurricane back in Nevis and St. Croix. And then, you know, when the Constitution was written, somebody asked him how come the Constitution doesn't dwell upon God and religion. And he jokingly says, well, we forgot. But he's joking. You know, it's that the founders, I mean, Madison was particularly emphatic about that, really were not religious literalists. In a contemporary, perhaps evangelical way. But Washington and Hamilton, though, would sort of phase in and out, it appears. And Washington was fairly steady about it and really just is all about religious pluralism and the strength of that for a society. And so he wanted to make sure it was a key part of the document and almost parallel with education in a way.
John Avalon is with us. His book is Washington's Farewell, The Founding Fathers' Warning to Future Generations. We'll take another quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Back now with John Avalon. We're talking about his book, Washington's Farewell, The Founding Fathers' Warning to Future Generations. You mentioned the play Cato, and I want to ask you a bit about that.
Sure.
Washington paid a lot of attention to the writer Joseph Addison, who wrote that play. And it seems like Washington and some of the other framers' suspicion of this hyper-partisanship was really rooted in a classical tradition. Addison was suspicious of it, but also Alexander Pope and David Hume was as well. Edward Gibbon warned factional fighting in his History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. So this was very much, I guess, being talked about, being debated at the time.
It was. And I think this is something that we forget too often. We consider moderation sometimes as the mushy middle. Yeah. And that could not be further from what the Founding Fathers believed. They believed in the strength of moderation, particularly for a self-governing people, rooted in classical wisdom. When they looked at the great moments of democratic republics up to that point, and they ruminated upon the fall and the failures. Edward Gibbon's book, Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, was a contemporary bestseller at precisely this time.
Right.
They realized that it was when societies became overextended, they got overextended politically, economically, in terms of foreign wars. That's when they became weakened because they were off center, and there was a wisdom to walking a middle path between the extremes, personally, and as a society at large. And so they were advocates of it. And for Addison, it was also a way of reflecting upon the horrors of the English Civil War, which was very much within living memory for the founding generation, the revolutionary generation, which we forget, I think, too often. So they were active, passionate advocates of the strength of moderation and its necessity to a democracy and self-governing society, and realized that it was extremism, ideological and otherwise, and partisan extremism that was the greatest threat to a democratic republic. And that's why they believed in studying history, to learn from its lessons. And I'll say one of the lessons that Washington and the founding generation really focused on, that when I was writing the book seemed a distant concern, but seems very different today, was the role particularly that foreign powers play when they try to interfere or influence domestic politics with an eye towards undermining national sovereignty. Washington was inflamed about it because the French had deployed an ambassador, Citizen Genet, to try to undermine his administration. And there were riots in the streets because they were furious about his proclamation of neutrality between Britain and France. But it was also something that happened to ancient Greek city-states with King Philip of Macedon pretending to be a friend, offering foreign aid, sowing the seeds of division, weakening the unity of a state, and then sliding in. So Vladimir Putin didn't met this playbook all by his own. And that's why studying history is so important. You know, as Harry Truman said, the only thing new in the world is the history you don't know. Right. And the founding fathers really understood that. And Washington did, too. And that's what informed so many of the pillars of liberty that he put forward in his farewell address, which is a memo from him to us.
You say Washington was an intuitive student of human nature. Mm. And so he got it. That people would look, people are going to just align themselves with some political ideology. He understood that. But I think this is almost one of the most crucial points, at least for me, from the book. But he figured that, as he put it, a wise and vigilant citizenry would come through and restrain those impulses and also restrain that impulse to follow a demagogue. So in many ways, and I think you mentioned this before, he puts the onus back on us.
Ultimately, it's all about us. Vigorous citizenship is the backstop for a self-governing society. There is no other who comes in to save us. We're all us. It's our common responsibility. And he does reconcile himself to the fact that political parties are probably an inevitable outgrowth of liberty in a democracy. But he says that we need to treat it like fire. Where we need to mind and tend the fire, lest instead of warming, it should consume, lest instead of providing constructive benefit, it should burn the whole house down. And that's the role of a wise and vigilant citizenry, to remain active. It's not someone else's problem. Self-government is a common responsibility, and it's a privilege in the context of human history. And that's, I think, where we get into danger, is we start to take our democracy for granted. And instead, we need to realize it's on us. It's always on us. And if the founding fathers warned against certain eternal principles, those are worth keeping in mind, not as a rigid straitjacket, but to keep in mind as guidelines, because demagogues will always sell the myth of us against them. That's their script. But what we need to do is instead recognize that our independence is inseparable from our interdependence as a people. And Washington understood that and tried to communicate that clearly in the farewell.
I want to ask you about Lin-Manuel Miranda's take on the address, because you write about this in the book. He really brings the making of that address to life in his play Hamilton in the song One Last Time. Talk about that.
He does, and it was extraordinary when I saw Hamilton for the first time, and I'm sitting in the play, and I'm probably halfway through with the book. And
is that right?
That's
so cool that you were thinking about this address, and then here it is on stage.
I was halfway through writing the book, and I went with my wife Margaret to go see it, and it was extraordinary that here there was a song in the play about this largely forgotten farewell address, and I it gave me great hope that perhaps this was not a fool's errand. But I interviewed Lin-Manuel for the book, and it's the final interview, and we talk a lot about the speech's applicability, because from different perspectives at different times, different aspects of its wisdom will jump out. Like Lyndon Johnson loved talking about the warnings about the importance of education. Reagan loved talking about religion. But for Lin-Manuel, the project is very much what I think our overall project needs to be, which is how we make the old stories new again, right. How we resonate. Because there's a temptation, perhaps among some, to look at the founding fathers and see only slave owners. And that would deprive us of so much of their wisdom. But we need to also deal with that fact. And Lin-Manuel's point is that we need to embrace the contradictions. We need to embrace the contradictions because it makes them so much more relatable and accessible. And the way he sets up the song One Last Time, he told me, is particularly, I think, resonant and gives a sense of how much he thought about what I believe is a great work of art, that play. With Hamilton in that song delivers the words, and he uses words from the farewell address in the song. He delivers the words as prose, while Washington, played by Chris Jackson, elevates it into song by virtue of embodying it. So Hamilton speaks the lines, Washington sings them. And that for Lin-Manuel is a metaphor for their working relationship.
Right.
And it works very, very well.
Yeah. Hamilton's prose, but Washington's ideas. There's a section of the speech which Miranda puts to music, you mentioned, from the final paragraphs of the speech, where Washington, and I thought this was important to take note of as well, where Washington mentions his own fallibility, the possibility of error, his defects. You sort of referred to it earlier, but why did Miranda find that part so inspiring? Because we are all always in the process of making it a more perfect union, but we don't quite get there?
Well, that's a certainly transcendently true. But Washington, I mean, he quotes basically the last paragraph of the farewell address, which is a beautiful and eloquent summation of the spirit of fellow citizenship. But Washington was always mindful of his failures and defects and never put himself above the people or pretended to be perfect. He was a man of ambition. He was a man of vision, but he never pretended to be perfect. And he was a reluctant president in part because he knew he was risking his reputation, but he felt it was worth it. And, you know, when he writes about his own failings, and he asks to be forgiven by fellow citizens for any mistakes he make, it's not a perfunctory pose. That's deeply personal and honest. And I think it reinforces one of the truly beautiful things about Washington's farewell address and the example he set as our first president that we need to remember, which is that virtue and moderation and character were the key qualities that enabled the success of the revolution. And in fact, there's one quote that I use as the epigraph. It's Jefferson, who's really a lifelong frenemy of George Washington. He becomes a convert to Washington's ideas once he becomes president himself. But yeah. Jefferson writes, "The moderation and virtue of a single character probably prevented this revolution from being closed, as most others have been, by a subversion of the liberty it was intended to establish." That had been the story of revolutions and failed republics throughout history. And Washington's strength of example, rooted in virtue and moderation and character, that was the key to making our country different. That is the key to the success of the American experiment to date. That is the key to, I believe, American exceptionalism.
You see, Jefferson and Madison both switched policies once they became president. They advocated policies that they once attacked. And in that sense, you write this, you say, in that sense, Washington won the debate beyond the grave, which I think is really interesting. Again, moderation as one of those really important pillars.
As a core civic virtue rooted in classical wisdom, this is not a split the difference position. This is bedrock wisdom handed down directly from the founding fathers that we have lost. And when Jefferson flip-flops on his great first inaugural speech, which is where the term entangling alliances come from, by the way, often the most famous phrase attributed to the farewell address, but it doesn't appear in it. When Jefferson takes his oath of office, he basically becomes a born-again Washingtonian on day one. After fighting so many of those policies for so long. And in part, it's because where you stand is often a matter of where you sit. Mm-hmm. But it's also because there was a gravity to Washington's perspective that transcended the kind of narrow self-interest that often drives partisan considerations. You know, they always pretend it's about policy. They always pretend it's about principle. But often it's just specious self-interest. And there's a deeper keel to Washington's wisdom, which is why so many folks ultimately in the presidency have gravitated towards it. Even when they fought with him among the fractious fights of the founding brothers, they ultimately came around because he had a wisdom that was deeper. When Eisenhower wrote his farewell address, he drew on Washington's farewell address. And it really is a reminder that this is this great forgotten document that Washington consciously was trying to bridge the past, the present, and the future. And it's a gift to us. And now we need to apply it more consistently to our own debates.
You say we need a new generation of Washingtonians.
Yeah.
Do you see one coming?
I am hopeful. You know, Lincoln is once rumored to have said, I'm an optimist because I don't see the point in being anything else. And there's a Western pragmatism to that I like. But I do. I think if you look and you see that, you know, more than 40% of millennials self-identify as independent, you know, there is the largest and fastest growing segment of the American electorate. And Washington was an independent president, and he preached a philosophy, a political philosophy of independence, of liberty, of self-sufficiency. But it always balanced individual liberty with generational responsibility. And I think that's the key balance we need to strike politically and not put the Pavlovian sort of partisan response first when we deal with politics, and recognize instead that that's the problem. That we need to build on the foundation, the idea that there's always more than unites us than divides us, that we need to be suspicious about overextension and that of any kind, fiscal, you know, political and foreign policy, that we need to be distrustful of people who would try to divide fellow citizens against one another, that these don't represent our best traditions, and that we need to reconnect with that founding wisdom. So I am hopeful that a new generation of Washingtonians can emerge out of what I believe is the independent movement in American politics. But it's going to mean that we need to disenthrall ourselves and to really consciously try to find a sense of common ground and common purpose again that can be rooted in policies that reflect deeper wisdom about the larger tides of history and the responsibilities of self-governance. But we need to feel a sense of urgency about that right now.
John Avalon, he's the editor-in-chief of The Daily Beast. His new book is called Washington's Farewell, The Founding Fathers' Warning to Future Generations. He joined us from a studio in New York City. John, it was really good to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
It was a great pleasure, as always, Doug. Thank you so much.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction today from Nicole Nixon. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.
Though in reviewing the incidents of my administration, I am unconscious of intentional error, I am nevertheless too sensible of my defects not to think it probable that I may have committed many errors. I shall also carry with me the hope that my country...